Veldibra, which is Norwegian for very good, because that's where I just come from. It's very hot in here. Must be because it was very cold in Oslo. So please get yourselves nice and comfortable. And when you're nice and comfortable, I will start this evening's Dhamma talk. Very good. Well, nice ones coming in. So when I come back from overseas, there's always lots of emails and letters and stuff to do. And I've got a letter that was actually in the tray, a very nice letter from one of the long-standing members of our Buddhist society. And fortunately, she's not here this evening. She'll be quite surprised. I actually do read the letters, and I do listen to people's comments, and I do try and take them on board. Because even though you're a monk, but as a monk, you never saw this big shot, you know, where you can't sort of take advice. You always listen and see what people say. And it's very nice to be that. One of the nice things about Buddhism, when the Buddha passed away, or just beforehand, when they asked him, who's going to be the boss of Buddhism once you pass away? He said, no one will be the boss of Buddhism. And that's why we never have a pope, or an archbishop, or anything like that. That sort of, you know, everybody is trying to be like friends. They have this beautiful word, Kalyanamitta, like good friends. That's the name that's adopted for our youth group, Kalyanamitta. Anyway, so there's no boss, so we always try and keep a sense of humility, especially as a monk. I'm supposed to have no self, so I'm supposed to be pretty humble. Actually, I really practice humility a lot. So much so that I think now I am the most humble monk in the whole world. And I'm really trying to get into the Guinness Book of Records for humility to see if I can get the most humble monk. And of course, that's what they call an oxymoron, you know. Not just messing around with you. But the message was that she said, well, you know, every week when, you know, you come here, I talk about how to live life without any suffering, you know, trying to sort of talk about how to overcome anxieties, depression, how to live in a marriage, and especially that. I was giving some talks about marriage over in, I think it was Oslo, and in the UK, I was there as well. It was amazing, just that I've been a monk for 37 years now. And people came up to me, it was actually Ajahn Brahmali's parents, and said, you really know a lot about marriage. It's weird, isn't it? But anyhow, they were asking, instead of just always focusing on that, it'd be nice to know something about, you know, traditional Buddhism. So if I can keep this up, I'm going to try every Friday night, maybe the next few weeks, trying to take a more traditional subject of Buddhism, talk about it, and then sort of explain how it relates to our daily life. And the one I decided to talk about tonight was the very first teaching which the Buddha gave after his enlightenment. It's a brilliant teaching, very simple. He said it was the middle way. And so today is a talk on the middle way. And so all the really great Buddhists are the ones in the middle, just over here. You're on extremes, you're just right. No, it doesn't mean that at all. Because what it really means is that there is a sense that you usually find the greatest happiness and peace and satisfaction in life by, you know, avoiding some of the extremes which we have in life. Because, you know, some of the extremes which we have in life, especially extremes of wealth, extremes of power, by extremes of wealth, I mean either lots of wealth or no wealth, lots of power or just having no influence at all in life. You know, you find that, you know, psychologically, health-wise and spiritually, always very damaging to people. So, now that I've mentioned many, many times, that please don't be wealthy. But don't be poor either. Try and find this little balance. I remember reading as a student Plato's Republic, And it was the last chapter of that was mentioning just how they had their ideas. This is in ancient Greece. They had their ideas of reincarnation. And I think that Plato, this great Greek philosopher, he said as a guy who remembered his last life and also the passage from one life to the other. And that when they died, this is how I recall it, when they died, the boatman takes them over the river Styx, S-T-Y-X, and they go to the Elysian fields where you rest for a while. And you know, some of you may have known those words before, especially Elysian fields, a place like of heaven. And then that you can choose your new life, your next life. Not so, well, there is a sense of karma there, but the way that the karma worked in Plato's ideas was actually very, very nuanced, very great, because he said that you could choose whatever life you wanted. But the reason why we choose is because of our karma, all of our inclinations, just the way we make our decisions in life. That is where karma really works. It's not so much karma gives us, you know, the experience this, experience that. Karma actually moves us to make a choice to the left or to the right. And he says all the really stupid people, all the ones with bad karma, they choose to be wealthy. Or they choose to be powerful, or they choose to be famous. Because you should know that anyone who is wealthy, rich and famous has an enormous amount of suffering in life. It's bad enough being Ajahn Brahm. People keep recognizing me. And my great fear, my greatest fear, and I was just chatting with Ajahn Bamali and also about that, he's over there right now, which chatting was my greatest fear, that someone would sit next to me on the plane from London to Singapore, which is 12 hours flight, who knew me and wanted to get counselling about their marriage. Because on an aircraft you can't escape. And they'd be talking to me for 12 hours and you want to have a rest. That's my greatest fear. Fortunately it never came about. But similar things have happened to me before. Really, really tired. And someone, they're really in a bit of a problem. They want to sort of ask you questions. And, you know, sometimes you're compassionate. Well, you try and be always compassionate. So you always want to give something to people, whatever you can give. But, you know, sometimes you can understand that being really too famous, it gives you a lot of suffering. And imagine if you were really famous. Imagine, like, you know, poor Queen Elizabeth. I mean, look, how old is she now? She's, sorry? 85. You know, can't you retire as a queen? I mean, she still has to keep on giving speeches and going all over the world. You'd think that, you know, she could be living in a nice little place, playing bingo with people or whatever else people do, just having a nice little bit of fun and games instead of having to go all over the world and dress up and meet all these people. And, oh, it must be terrible being that. But that's what happens when you become sort of rich and famous. Unfortunately, she's done pretty well in her life. But, you know, some of the other people who are royals, you get all these paparazzi just waiting to take a photograph of you when you pick your nose. And that is what goes on the newspapers the next day. It must be so awful being sort of, you know, a paparazzi, not being, well, awful being a paparazzi, but awful being sort of a famous person, as it is being a person who has got no worth at all. And many of you may have been to that extreme as well. You know, sometimes you get so disappointed, depressed, sometimes this life bottoms out and you think you're not worth anything. You know, I'm hopeless, I really tried hard, I can't get my relationships together, my wealth is not so good, my health is not so good. And that's almost the opposite of like this fame business, you know, when everyone thinks you're so great and important, and there are times in your life when you feel that, you know, that you have no value at all. Other people have argued with you, demeaned you, you made mistakes in life, or, you know, just things which happen in life give you that sense of having no meaning or worth. That is an extreme. So be careful of those two extremes of fame and this feeling of worthlessness. And if you can find a middle way, that's the best of all. So, because whenever I go travelling, as more and more people get to know me, and this internet gets me quite famous, so I think it's about time I get a disguise. Maybe when I go overseas, I can get like a beard. You know, you can get them from these shops. And especially a wig. Then I can and have a good time when no one really knows who I am. But then I don't have to give any talks, whatever. But now the best thing is actually to be you guys. You know, just really, you're much smarter than I am. I bow to you. You are much wise. How I got myself in this position, I don't know. So, you know, you can practice your meditation, you can walk down the street, you have your friends, but you're not sort of notorious. And so you haven't got any of those people who saw that picture of me in that birthday booklet. I've got a big cut-out cardboard copy of myself in the bookshops in Jakarta. That was really amazing when you go in a bookshop, because, you know, the books that open the door of your heart book, which I wrote, translated into Indonesian, was a very, very popular book. And so in the bookshops there's a big cardboard cutout of me. And it was really a shock seeing yourself in a cardboard cutout, although I did think that gave me a few good ideas. Because when I was in England, in London recently, that's why I went over to London to visit my family and to try and heal up some of the things with the Bhikkhuni ordination and give some talks and then go to Oslo. I did try, but I never actually got there. I tried to go to that Madame Tussauds. You know that Madame Tussauds? I want to see how much it costs to get, you know, a model of myself so I can put it here on a Friday night. You know, I tell the same old jokes every week, so, you know, you wouldn't really notice it. They could actually program it to sell the same jokes and then sit up here and I can be down in my cave in Sermatan having a wonderful time. Anyhow, so the point is that, you know, just trying to be that in the middle there somewhere is the most comfortable option for people. You know, with wealth it's the same. You know, with wealth, that many, many times people have done the research. It's very simple to do because you know the theory behind this. People who are poor, it's a lot of a struggle, you know, to pay your bills and also to get those little things which you can enjoy in life. So it's nice to have enough money just so you don't have to worry about, you know, where you're going to pay the next electricity bill. And you've got a little bit extra there so you can treat yourself to a nice meal or even like, you know, a nice holiday somewhere overseas. But you can, you know, a lot of people don't even have that. And especially over in England right now, because they really got hit by the European debt crisis. And so it's very, very difficult out there. And it reminded me of the story, because I think you can understand this is the introduction to a joke about this man in a Rolls Royce. And he was passing along one of these roads in England. And you know what he saw? He saw a man eating grass. That's how bad it had become. I got nothing to eat at all, so I was resorting to eating grass. So this man in his Rolls Royce, very rich, stopped and said, "What are you doing?" And the man said, "Look, I'm so poor, this is all I've got to eat, no grass." And this very, very wealthy man said, "Look, I can help you. Please come in my car." And this poor man said, "Well, look, it's not just me, it's my wife and children as well." "Bring them all in," said the rich man. "I can help all of you." And the whole family went into the Rolls Royce car thinking, you know, sometimes we criticize, you know, extremely wealthy people for being selfish. But, you know, there was a lot of kind people out there. People were willing to stop and help those who were really, really struggling. And so the whole family got in the car and he took them back to the mansion. And as they sort of drove in, the driver of the car, the rich man, pointed out the very big, lush lawn He said, "I've got so much grass here, please help yourselves." Which is a disgusting joke. But look, just having the right amount is the best. So that does affect you. Because you know what it is sometimes that, you know, people look for an advancement in their career. An advancement in their career, yes, you do make more money, but do you really need that much more money? I know, say, some Thai people, they get a nice Thai restaurant, it's doing well, and they expand it. And when they expand it, they get a second, and my goodness, they hardly have any time for anybody. And some of you, you know, you may try to get that promotion. Yeah, the promotion will give you more status, but is it really going to give you more time? I know that that's part of our life. We get jealous sometimes when somebody else gets a promotion, not us. If you are a smart person, you've been listening to these talks, let your friend get the promotion. Let them. Because they will get all the stress and you'll be able to have a much more easy time. And don't think that, yes, they get the promotion, they get more money. No matter how much money you have, it always satisfies the criteria of never enough. How many of you here have got enough income? Put your hand up if it's enough. Only the monks, I think, the monks. Because you can always do with some more, can't you? That's what I mean, it's never... That's why not be satisfied with the not enough you've got now, rather than not enough you'll get with more stress. In other words, keep a middle way, just enough, that's fine. And the same with any other status which you have, just that middle way, you'll find that's the happiest. And those of you who are looking for a partner in life, again, don't get the most beautiful girl. Don't get the ugliest one either, you know, middle way. Because if you get the ugliest one, you know, your friends will probably take you for eye tests. And the worst, if it's the most beautiful one, you'll always be jealous. You'll always be wondering, so, you know, what other people are doing when they look at her and admire her. It's not really worthwhile. And it's the same way if you're a girl. Never get the most wealthiest, hunkiest guy. If he is that wealthy, he can afford another couple of mistresses as well as you. So get someone who's... It happens, doesn't it? Come on. So get someone who's just about the right income. Because if they're too poor, you know, then you they'll never be able to get the house and look after the kids. So you want to get that just middle-income guy. So if you see someone who's filthy rich at a party, leave them alone. Don't go for them, for goodness sake. That's a foolish person who gets the really rich, uber-rich people. Get the nice middle one. You know, not too rich, not too poor. Middle way is very beautiful in life. But the main reason the Buddha taught the middle way was actually in, you know, your spiritual life. Yeah, it really works. Okay, another thing. Again, your car. The car which you've got, please, you know, don't get the Ferrari. Don't get the old bomb. If it's a Ferrari, some kids in Perth will come with the coins or metal and scratch it. The old bomb means you can't actually get to Nolamara Temple without having to call the RAC every Friday. You know, you want just one which gets you somewhere, which is nice and easy. It's the same also. I think many of you who come here regularly have learned this by practice. Never wear the most expensive shoes when you come to Nolamara. Because sometimes it's, you know, like we share things, you know, so, you know, you take their shoes and, you know, they take your shoes. It sometimes happens. You know, this actually happened here some years ago. There was, you know, sometimes that people, you know, lose their shoes when they come here, because there's about 200 or 300 of you sometimes that somebody will. They think it's their shoes and they take the wrong shoes home. And it's just what happens. But you know, there was a case about over 4 or 5 weeks, people would lose only one shoe of the pair. And that was really, really weird. You know, and it, not just once, but about over 4 or 5 weeks, one shoe would be missing. And so we really did suspect a one-legged thief. Because who else would want one shoe? You know, the solution was a couple of houses down the road. The woman looked inside the dog kennel and it was full of shoes. It was true. This little dog would actually come over here and pick a shoe or two and take it home to the... Who knows? It had this, you know, psychological trait in dogs, you know, just a shoe fetish. I think it must have liked the smells. You know what shoes smell like. So anyway, if you come to Nolamara, don't wear the worst shoes, because that would be embarrassing. Not the best shoes, the middle shoes you've got. And then they will never be stolen, and also they'll be comfortable to wear. So there's a lot of things about the middle way, but the most important part of the middle way, what the Buddha was saying, look, please don't be so forceful, you know, in the way you practice your religions. And so extreme and austere. Because there's something about religions, especially, where we think that the more strict you are, you know, just the more austere you are, so the quicker you'll get to enlightenment or heaven or wherever you want to go. And you read some of the things which these people used to do in the old days, flog themselves and just, you know, wear these belts sticking into you or whatever. And that's absolutely crazy. There's something really wrong there, you know, psychologically in a person. Now, is it really that you have to torture yourself in order to free the mind? That was part of many people's ideas of religion. And I remember that what that really meant for me was, I remember just talking to people over in Oslo, when I used to go to church, you know, just as a young man growing up in England, it was always really cold. There was no heating in those buildings at all. And it's very damp stone and these wooden benches, you know, with no upholstery or cushions on. And even the sort of the priests, they wore black. Now look, we wear this beautiful, you know, brown. It's encouraging, you know, it's just, it's bright and breezy brown. Instead of like... It is. Because look, when you wear black to funerals, don't you? So you see all these priests in black and it's so depressing. And that was actually, the austerity even went to that part, you know, of that religion. And be very careful, even with, you know, the religions like Buddhism, you can be far too austere. That's why we have chairs, so people can actually sit comfortably when they're listening to a talk or when they're meditating. You don't have to sit on the floor. It was tough when I first went to Thailand. I had to sit on the floor, you know, for hours and hours sometimes. And there was no carpet on the floor there. It was concrete. The worst part is that in that part of northeast Thailand, all the concrete floors were laid by the villagers. They're all bumpy. At least over here in Australia, they're smooth. So it was bumpy, uncomfortable, and, you know, you weren't allowed any cushions, especially for the junior monks. Actually, that's where I started to really complaining, because... If you have seen that birthday book of mine, when I was a young monk, I was really all skin and bones. You know, look what you've done to me. And I'm happy now. Actually, I said to a few people, "I, you know, that my problem is I'm suffering from anorexia." It's true, Because I looked at the definition of anorexia the other day. The definition of anorexia is you look in a mirror and you think you're fat. That's me. There's quite a few of you too. So I was very all skin and bones. And it was those senior monks, you know, when in many traditions we have this idea of hierarchies and seniority. So the very senior monks, they had the biggest cushion, just like me now. See, I've got the big cushion and these monks have got smaller cushions. At least they've got cushions. When I was a young monk, I had no cushion at all. So, you know, the bones could almost touch the concrete. And those senior monks, they had all these cushions. And I got very upset because those senior monks, they didn't need any cushions. You know, they had their own, what I call, natural upholstery. Which I've got now, called fat. And that's when, you know, I started developing this idea about, you know, what happens when you are in extremes. You always envy the other. And I started thinking, this really unfair. Those big fat monks had all the cushions. I was thin and skinny and had none. It should be the other way around. Because those fat monks, they didn't need the cushions. I did. Not only that, but the fat monks in those days, they got the best food. It was passed down the line. And I got the leftovers. You know, they didn't need the delicious food, I did, because, you know, they were all enlightened. I was just still, you know, travelling. I needed some more delicious food. And when I started, not only that, actually, the junior monks, we had to do all the hard work. While all the senior monks sat around talking to people all the time. And so when I was a junior monk, I envied those senior monks. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful one day when I'm a fat monk, talking to people all the day, don't have to do any work. Now I'm that monk. I envy those junior monks. They don't have to do much teaching and organising and answer questions on the aircraft about people's marriages. It's just so easy. And that's where I just decided that there's this idea in Buddhism called suffering. And to really understand it, that this is its essence here. As a junior monk, you know, thin, hungry, working hard, I had what's called junior monk suffering. And I really thought that once I got fat, once I had cushions, once I could have more, don't have to work so hard, I wouldn't have any suffering anymore. Now I'm a senior monk. I have senior monk suffering. And this is the problem. That we always try and think that our suffering, if we change our situation, it will disappear. If you're poor, you have poor people suffering. If you're rich, you have rich people suffering. This is the story of the two sisters. Some years ago, two sisters, they're two Thais, they came to me for counselling. Again, marriage relationship counselling. And I talked to the first sister, the elder one, first. Her problem was she had a husband she was having a very hard time with. She was really thinking of separating. And I was giving her all these techniques, ways that she could try and make something out of her marriage. Sometimes it's never too late. I've actually counselled people and been with people and it's really been on the edge. And they've got their act together and they've gone back together again and they really do live happily ever after. I've seen that. It can be done. So I gave her everything I got to try and sort of give her strategies so that she could make the marriage work. But basically, she had a husband she didn't want. And then when I talked to her younger sister, her problem was that, you know, she was a young, attractive girl, but she couldn't find a partner. She'd go out with these boys, maybe a couple of weeks, a month, 6 weeks at most, and it would all fall apart. She couldn't actually find, you know, that person for her. So I was now giving her all sorts of ideas of what they could do, you know, to try and make herself a bit more attractive, to try and see the nice thing in the guy you know, praise him a bit, be more kind to him or whatever it was, just so that she could be a bit more attractive and just get past that moment when, you know, the relationship just didn't work, so you have a more long-term partner. But basically, you know, she wanted a husband. And then I had a great insight, because monks can become very innovative. You know, as I say, we can think out of the box because we live out of the box. We don't live in the world you live in, so that's why we can think totally differently. So there was a problem. Her elder sister had a husband she didn't want, and her younger sister wanted a husband. Isn't it obvious? Swap! And I mentioned that to them. They didn't appreciate my wisdom. So in the end, I really told it to them, exactly what I told you a few moments ago. The older sister had husband suffering. And I said, that's what it's like to have a husband. And there's many wives here who know exactly what I mean. You know, that problem you have with that guy, you know, what frustrates you sometimes, and think, gee, you know, do I have to be like this? Yes, it has to be like that. That's called husband suffering. And I know this because many wives have talked to me, and it's always the same. Husband suffering, okay? It comes with the marriage. And the younger sister, she didn't have that particular type of suffering. She had single woman suffering. So what happened? Any girls here who are thinking of like divorcing, getting rid of your husband, yeah, you won't have husband suffering anymore, but you will have single woman suffering afterwards. And any of single women here who think, oh, I just want someone to share my life with, I really want a husband, yes, you won't have single woman suffering anymore, you will have husband suffering. You can't get away from it. Or can you? Because the way to get away with it is, don't change the outside, change the inside. And just be a bit more content and appreciative, you know, of the man or the woman you happen to be with. And this is actually one of the things which I've noticed, because, you know, that many I've been here for 28 years, and I know a lot of you, and you're really nice people, respect you, I get to know you, very kind, generous and loving, hard-working. And then sometimes the two of you get married. And I think, my goodness, you're really both really kind, beautiful people. Why on earth can't you love each other? It's interesting, isn't it? You can be really, really good, kind, wonderful person, and the other's a good, really kind, wonderful person. But when they get together, there's something happens, and they argue. It's such a difficult thing. I think it's because they lose respect. They lose that sort of seeing those incredibly beautiful qualities in the other. And if you lose that respect and you don't see the beauty in the other person, then it doesn't work. That's why this is another middle way which I love to talk about. If you are in a relationship, when you see your partner, don't see your partner, don't see him, see what's actually in between the two of you. And what's actually in the middle of you? This energy which runs between you. Because that is where relationships live. Relationship doesn't live within me and you. It is in this beautiful space between us. And I've done that many times when I've been talking to a person or sort of counselling them or whatever. I've tried to put, you know, between me and you these beautiful qualities, what I know is very positive, very beautiful, very lovely. And things like kindness, forgiveness, respect especially. And I put that between me and whoever comes up here afterwards when they ask questions. And I did this when he was in prison, talking to people who had done horrendous crimes. I put this respect between me and the person I was talking to. So when I looked at them, I was actually looking through respect. I was taking respect from me to them. So I did have respect, I did have kindness, I did have generosity, because that was between me and them. So it's a very skillful way of looking how relationships work. What's between you and that person? And the way I got that from was the way I meditated. Because when you're meditating, it's between me, the observer, and the object which I'm meditating on. It's what was going on in between. That was where the important part was. So, you know, like, look, just... Actually, it's really weird. So I really jet-lagged, tired, because I go on these flights. I just came in from Oslo. I think it's the total was about 27, 8-hour flight or something. Landed this afternoon and just come and give a talk this evening. You know, that's human rights abuse from the Buddhists. But when I was meditating, I was very, very tired. You know, worried about whether I go to sleep. So what I did, my sleepiness, you know, that tiredness, that particular feeling in the body and in the brain, you know that. And here was this observer, separated from it, and I put this beautiful energy between myself and my tiredness, which was very much just letting things be. This acceptance, this respect. Now I respect my tiredness, so I don't try and fight it and control it. Now when I'm sick, I respect my sickness. It's not something I try and get rid of. But I respect it, learn and be with it and understand it. Because for me, if I'm sick, or if I'm tired, if I'm aching, it's me, the observer. There is this pain, this ache. What's between me and that? Now, even if I really get into my meditation, get into some breath, it's not just the breath out there and me, the observer. It's how am I watching that breath? What's between me, the relationship which I have and my meditation object, if it happens to be the breath? And of course, once you realise that's a middle way, a huge amount of understanding happens. If you've ever done the breath meditation, you know, that's when, you know, during the meditation you start watching the breath. Has it ever happened to you? You're watching the breath go in, go out, and after about 3 or 4 breaths, your mind wanders away. And you can't follow the breath very long. Why? And when I started noticing what was between me and the breath, it became very clear. And to this day, I give this simile. I just gave this over in Oslo a couple of days ago when I did a meditation day for everybody, you know, from 9 till 7, I think it was, sorry. And I said, the reason why your mind wanders off is because you treat your breath like a slave, like a servant, and you're this big master or mistress. You treated it so bad that when your breath sees you coming, it races away, it goes and hides, it sees you coming and it scarpers because you treated it so badly. And the main simile I gave was imagine that tomorrow afternoon your friend gives you a call and say, let's go out for coffee. And they continue to say, we're not going to go to Starbucks or McDonald's, we're going to go to Gloria Jean's. And you're going to sit at my table in the corner, not on the veranda. I know you like sitting on there, but I'm inviting you, we're going in the corner table. And you're going to sit on the chair on the left, not the chair on the right. You sit in the chair on the left. And you're going to have a flat white, or flat black, whatever it's called, not a latte, not a cappuccino, not a cup of tea. You're going to have that with soy milk, not skim milk or whatever else. And we're going to be talking about Buddhism. We're not going to talk about Christianity or the sport or fashion. We want to talk about Buddhism for 2 hours, nothing less, nothing more, because that's the amount of time I have. I'll see you tomorrow. What would your response be? I'm really busy, you know. I've got an important I've got to go to see the doctors. Whatever it is, make any excuse. Do you like being with people like that? Control freaks? Telling you what to do, where to go, where to sit, what to drink? No one would do that. But that's exactly what you do with your body and mind. Come on, sit still. Come on, you've got to get up early. Come on, you've got to go and get to work. Come on, you've got to run faster. Come on, you've got to meditate. Come on, you've got to be positive. Come on, you've got to be like this and be like that. Have you seen many people have dysfunctional relationships with their body and mind? And especially with their mind when they meditate. And that's one of the reasons why the mind recognizes you. Oh no, not her again. Oh God, what am I going to do? Let's get out of here. Fall asleep. Come on, that worked last time. I'm going to fall asleep. So, the way out of that problem, if you're meditating, maybe watching the breath, watching the body, whatever you're doing, I don't care. What's between you and your object? How are you doing that? Are you a control freak? Do you really think you are the master, the mistress, the control freak? That's one of the reasons why the Buddha taught anatta, non-self. No control, no one in charge. Just like when the Buddha passed away, as I said earlier, no one will be in charge after he passed away. No one in charge of your mind. So you know, in many retreats, had really good success. And you might try this. Try it on the weekend. You ask yourself when you got up tomorrow morning, good morning, body, good morning, mind. How are you today? What do you want to do? Ask your body what it wants to do. The body says, another 10 minutes, please. Okay. You can have another 10 minutes, but ask. And then what happens then? Because you are kind and sensitive to your body, your body actually doesn't throw any tantrums anymore. That's what cancers and other sicknesses is. That's your body throwing a tantrum. I'm going to show him. You've mistreated me. Your body will actually be your friend rather than something you control. Isn't it beautiful to treat your body like a friend, not something you own and control? Then your body is just usually pretty healthy. I look at my body and it's a friend. I've known my body all my life. We really get on together. That's why it's amazing that I'm very rarely sick. I should be sick the way I sort of run around all over the world and just work really hard. But no, it's very good, my body. Because I think I'm a great friend to it. So we really get on well. Same as, you know, my brother. Somebody asked me, I just come back from London, so I spent some time with my brother. You know, he came over for my 60th birthday. Those of you who saw him at monastery in Serpentine during the rains retreat. So, you know, I went stayed the night at his place and I talked with his family. And the following day I had all this Buddhist activities in the morning and lunchtime and afternoon, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon. He was supposed to come and, you know, spend all day and come to a talk I was giving in London. But about 3 or 4 o'clock in the afternoon he said, no, I've had enough Buddhism for today, I'm going home. It was really sweet and cute the way he said that. You know, he'd been Buddhist out for the day. He's not a Buddhist, but he's very supportive. So we were really great friends. So, you know, even though he was a banker, I didn't have any money. So, you know, opposite ends. But anyhow, actually you might call it extremes. I'm supposed to be talking about the middle way. But anyway, we get on together. Because it's what's between us, what's in the middle of us, that's what's really important. And that's in your meditation, what's between you and your body. And if you're a friend to the body, that's where we don't get that austerity and asceticism. Which, that was the main thing the Buddha was saying when he first taught that. He said he'd been trying so hard to get enlightened, really giving everything he got for 6 years and getting nowhere. And that's when he tried his beautiful middle way. Are you really trying hard to do things? I remember just trying to lay bricks, trying very, very hard, and it always went wrong. And then you relaxed and it became very smooth and you laid much better bricks. Have you ever seen that sort of that trying, that hardness? Actually, you don't achieve much. You get much softer, slower, go with the flower sort of things. That's it, go with the flower, or go with the flower. There's a joke there somewhere, but not this evening. As you go with the flow, it becomes much easier. You're not forcing. And by going with the flow is that same thing. You have this beautiful relationship with what you're doing. You're not forcing it, you're not being lazy. It's in the middle between you and that bricklaying, between you and washing the dishes. And washing the dishes. Somebody said this nice little quote I've never seen before. And this, I think, he said it came from this very, very old British Buddhist called Alan Watts. He says he's only ever washed one cup in his life. It didn't mean he was lazy. I know there are some husbands like that who never even washed one cup in their life. But what he really meant is only wash one cup at a time. Only one moment. That's his whole life. It's just one moment long. Very interesting sort of idea about life. Your life is only this moment. So you only ever listen to one talk. You only ever go to work for one day. You're only ever on holiday one day. This day, right now. But anyway, if you are washing the dishes, it's how you wash the dishes. So sometimes I want to get rid of it, get it out of the way. You know, so come off it. You know, it's really, I actually washed some dishes while I was away. And I really enjoy that because I don't get to do that. You know, I was staying with Ajahn Bhamani in his parents' apartment in Oslo. So his mother made some food for us and so we could wash the dishes afterwards. And I really enjoyed that. I tried to do that once in Serpentine Monastery. And I went in there and I tried to help, you know, wipe the dishes with the cloths. And a Thai girl, she came up to me without saying anything and took the cloth away. So monks are not supposed to do that. Oh, you really spoiled it. I just like doing some things we've never done before, like washing dishes. But anyway, it's how you wash the dishes. Do you look upon that as a chore you really hate doing, taking out the garbage or whatever else? It doesn't matter what the chore is. It's how you do it. What's between you and that chore? What's your relationship with this thing? What's your relationship with going to work on a Monday morning? What's between you and that event? And he was, oh no, not again. Why do I always have to do this? I'm going to become a monk. No. You won't have going to work on a Monday morning suffering anymore. You'll have giving a talk on a Friday night suffering instead. Remember, you don't get rid of suffering. You just change it. If you want to change the situation, how you get rid of suffering, put your energy, your focus in the middle between you and what you're doing. Make that positive. And then there's no suffering at all. It's how you go to work on a Monday morning. It's how you wash the dishes. It's how you watch the breath. You know, it's how you get sick. Sickness isn't the problem. It's what's between you and being sick. There's a problem. In that middle. For those of you who have cancer or know other people with cancer, it's not the cancer the problem. It's not you the problem. Sometimes we think we are the problem, we feel guilty, we feel something wrong with us. Don't put the problem there. Don't put the problem with the disease. That's part of nature. The problem is what's between you and that disease. How's it affecting you? What's in the middle there? So if you can create that space, here's me, this body, this sensitive, you know, human being who feels pain, who doesn't want to die yet. And you see this sort of, you know, terrible sickness, separate it a little bit, that's called a bit of detachment, and in between, look at what is between the two of you. Just like what's between the husband and wife, what's between the boss and the worker, what's between the abbot and the junior monk, what's between you and your cat, what's between the two of you. That is the middle, that is where the action of life is, that's where suffering is, that's where the end of suffering is. In that middle point. And if you see that middle point, that middle way, it's amazing what you can do to solve all the problems of your life. You can't change the world. You know you can't really change yourself. Here you are. What you can do, you can change what's in between the two of you. In a way, it's changing the self. In a way, it's changing the world. But what it really is changing the relationship between you and that thing. So when I was tired, jet lag, whatever, I was just watching that feeling and being at peace with it. Can't control it. I was being a friend to it. So it's not just saying to your body when you go up in the morning, body, what do you want to do today? Yeah, an extra 15 minutes. Started off at 10 minutes, but now it's increased to 15 minutes of sleep. Also ask your mind, what do you want to do today? how are you? Until you get this wonderful friendly relationship with your mind. Yeah, you're negative because something's happened. Okay, mind, I allow you to be negative. You don't have to be so positive every day. So, you're angry because something's happened to you. Okay, mind, you can be angry if you like. I will still love you and respect you no matter what you do. So what are you putting in between you and that emotion? You'll find then, I'm depressed. Depression's out here, here's me. What's between the two of you? Be friendly, be respectful, and you'll find that the problem vanishes. You're not fighting anymore, you're putting this beautiful, wonderful, good qualities, and you all know what those good qualities are. Friendship, kindness, peace, respect. Put that between you and whatever you're watching. Whoever's in front of you, mentally, physically, emotionally. And then you'll find you don't have to change the world. You found the place where the world becomes peaceful. What's between you and the husband? Between you and the sickness? Between you and the depression? Between you and the anxiety? Put the attention there, in that middle. And you'll find there the solution lies. There's another way of dealing with this middle way. And all this austerity and asceticism, this hardness, which, you know, you read in the Buddha scriptures, the hardness of the Buddha before he became enlightened. Fasting, austerities, which is reflected. You don't see it on the outside, but you see that in people's minds. In their emotional world, they're so hard on themselves. Trying to force themselves to get better, striving and striking like the Buddha, fasting, doing all these ascetic practices, standing on one leg, facing the sun all day. That's an amazing amount of things which people do to hurt themselves. Sometimes you do that in your mental world, don't you? So hard on yourself, so unforgiving, so cruel. So between you and your mind, please, follow the Buddha's path. Compassion, kindness, peace, respect. Do that and you find a lot of the problems are solved. Emotionally, meditationally, and in the physical world, marriage, work, sickness, or whatever. And most importantly, please put this beautiful appreciation, kindness, and thank you between you and the monk you're looking at right now. Thank you for listening to my talk. That's a middle way talk. Okay, has anyone got any questions or comments about this evening's jet lag talk? Yes, please. Oh, now you're talking. You'll say, I had this big cut-out copy photograph of myself in Indonesia. But some years ago, there was a group in Singapore. I was giving some huge talks in, I think it was in Suntec City, the convention centre there. And they had to advertise. So they managed to get advertised with my picture on the back of a bus. And I remember going there and said, let's go, because it wasn't on every bus, only a few buses. So I remember just driving around trying to find one, which was really good fun. And finally found it, there I am. And the reason is because it is an Australian saying. It's not a very nice comment when you say, you've got a face like the back of a bus. And for once, yes, it was true. I had the face like a back of a Singapore bus. So, okay, you have that. Now, what are you going to put between you and that? I put great fun. Whenever I make a mistake, you make a mistake, you do something really stupid. What do you put between you and that mistake? I put laughter. And I just have a really good time when I make mistakes. So that's what you should do. Thank you for that very profound question.